This is the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. On September 20th, a public forum on the role of religion in politics was presented by the group Clergy and Laity United for Justice and Peace. The event featured perspectives from Jewish, Christian, and Islamic perspectives and is moderated by Carl Matthews.
Let me turn to our panelist, Russ Linden, who will start off. Russ is a management educator and adjunct professor at the University of Virginia, the Federal Executive Institute, and the University of Maryland. He's received considerable notice for his writing, particularly his most recent book, Working Across Boundaries, Making Collaboration Work in Government and Nonprofit Organizations, and for a series of articles he has written for the Virginia Review, where he's a contributing editor. A member of Clergy and Laity United for Justice and Peace, Russ spends considerable time and effort working with programs to help low-income students succeed in school and continue on to college. His American Jewish heritage and rearing has contributed significantly to his views on religion and politics, which he will share with us tonight. Russ?
Thank you so much, Carl, and thanks to Clergy and Laity United. This is a wonderful topic, and it's an extraordinary turnout, and I hope it's an indicator that this issue of religion and politics will animate all of us, and not only, as Carl said, people with one particular point of view. Thanks to the panel members. I'm really honored to be here. I should tell you just a little bit about myself so you'll have a sense of where my comments are coming from. And then I'm looking forward to the exchange and the questions. I consider myself an observant Jew, not an Orthodox Jew, however. I don't see myself as deeply knowledgeable on a variety of what the experts say in Judaism about this topic versus that. I'll do my best to tell you what I think are the mainstream Jewish beliefs and consequences and thoughts on various issues. But you should know there's an old phrase, two Jews, three opinions. So anyone here, Jewish or not, will probably be able to find many sources and many exceptions to the things I say. I'll do my best. I'll welcome those who might have different views. One more note by way of introduction. Like many American Jews, I'm a strong, ardent supporter of the State of Israel. I give money and time there. Like some American Jews, I sometimes find myself upset, even very angry, with the policies of Israel's leaders. Be that as it may, I don't understand tonight's session to be about Israel. I think that would be a wonderful session, perhaps one for this organization to sponsor at some other time. My understanding of our topic is that it's more about religion and politics. Okay. So in thinking through and reviewing many of our religion's ancient texts and traditions, certain themes emerge. I'll list five. Individual free will and responsibility for our actions. Mutual responsibility. We Jews see ourselves as connected to and in some ways responsible for others. The Hebrew phrase, tikkun olam, which means to heal and repair the world, is a third theme. Fourth, social justice, not only as a theory and a belief, but in our everyday actions. And five, an emphasis on action, perhaps much more than on faith. We'll talk a little bit about each. First, we Jews see ourselves as human beings born with free will, not with original sin. Although if you know some Jewish folks, you'll know that most of us are so consumed with guilt, you might think we believe in original sin. We see ourselves as individuals who are responsible for the choices we make. In Judaism, we're taught the individual is created in God's image. That's one reason why in the Talmud, an enormous compilation of laws, beliefs, interpretations, it says that if you save one person, it's as though you've saved the world. Who knows what that one person could do? In Deuteronomy 30:19, the Israelites are told, "See, I have set you before this day life and death, blessing and curse. Choose life, therefore, that you and your descendants may live." We'll be reading these beautiful lines in our high holiday services coming soon. Moses makes clear what God wants us to do. To choose life, but notice the verb, choose. We're taught that we have free will, and we frequently make mistakes, and God teaches us we'll have consequences. Second, and perhaps a paradox, while there's this focus on individualism and free will and individual responsibility, we're also taught in a variety of ways that we are mutually responsible for one another. I remember so vividly being 8 or 10 and reading something in Sunday school about God looking for Cain after Cain slew his brother Abel and says, "Where's your brother Abel?" And Cain says, "Am I my brother's keeper?" We all know those haunting lines. And I asked my mom what she thought. Are we our brother's keeper? And she looked at me with this incensed, determined look, and she said, "We're our brother's brother." As though that's enough to know, right? We're brothers. We're sisters. We take care of one another. On Yom Kippur, the holiest day, the most awesome day of our coming holidays, when we confess our sins, and there's a long litany of sins, we don't talk about individual sins or mistakes. The Hebrew can be read either way. We say the Hebrew words, Al Chet Shechatanu Lefanecha, which translates, "For the sins we have committed." Now, if you look at this long list of 15, 20, 30 sins, you wouldn't guess that most of us sitting in the synagogue have committed all or most. We say every one of those sins. My way of looking at that is we assume someone here or elsewhere has sinned, and we all have to take responsibility. Third, most Jews are taught at an early age that one of our purposes on earth is tikkun olam, which, as I said, is to heal and repair the world. God wants us to be happy. Ours is not a belief system in which we're supposed to avoid all positive things. A joyful sex with a loved one is wonderful. A great meal, looking at God's incredible, awesome earth. These are all emphasized by our God. But that's not all God wants. We're taught over and over that we're here to make a better world. One of the most sublime lines, as I read the Hebrew Bible, comes from Isaiah. On the day of Yom Kippur, when we Jews are to fast for 24 hours, we read Isaiah chapter 58. He's challenging us, he's rebuking us, as the prophet so often did, that we're not fasting the way we're supposed to. Isaiah says, "Is not this the fast I look to unlock the shackles of injustice, to undo the fetters of bondage, to let the oppressed go free, to break every cruel chain, to share your bread with the hungry, to bring the homeless poor into your house." All of us could go forward with those or similar lines that probably most of us have read. The great Jewish rabbi Hillel preached, "Do not separate yourself from your community." Indeed, I recently learned the most frequent injunction in the Hebrew Bible is, "Welcome the stranger." The context, when read in a longer section, typically is, "Welcome the stranger, for you were strangers in a strange land when we were enslaved in Egypt." Over and over, we're told in a variety of ways, we are here to improve the world. Next, closely related to tikkun olam is social justice. In Leviticus 19:2, the Bible tells us, "You shall be holy, for I, the Lord, am holy." What exactly does that mean? Well, the verses immediately after perhaps give a hint. The verses then say, we are to provide for the poor and for the stranger, to avoid theft, to make impartial decisions in court, to treat the blind and the deaf fairly. And then a phrase that I've always loved and thought so much about, I'm sure many of you are familiar with this, in Deuteronomy 16:20, it says, justice shall you pursue. The rabbis wondered, why is the word repeated? Well, one of the kind of core beliefs or ways of understanding the Hebrew Bible, the rabbis teach us, is to look for repetition. Justice. This is no accident when we find words repeated. Another interpretation is you will use just means to arrive at just ends. So these are the phrases, these are the injunctions we're taught over and over that have to do with social justice. A statistic for those of you who are interested in numbers. Given this enormous emphasis on social justice, it's probably not surprising that a poll of U.S. Jews in the late 1980s reported that half of Jews polled said a commitment to social equity was the most important factor in their Jewish identity. Second, but only 17%, cited religious observance, only 17% cited support of Israel. Almost half said, "I am Jewish, that means social justice is what I'm about." Finally, Judaism is a religion of action. I remember so well a picture of a wonderful rabbi named Abraham Heschel, who walked more than once with Martin Luther King on some of King's extraordinary, brave walks for social justice. Afterward, the rabbi was asked about his role. He was wearing a yarmulke, a kippah. It was not by accident that he was there, and he didn't want anyone to think he just happened to be there. He wanted to be there to be seen by the cameras as a rabbi, as a committed Jew. And Heschel said, "I was praying with my legs. I was praying with my legs." That was the role. That was how he understood what it was all about. We're people of action. We believe in faith, but as I've been taught about Judaism, I think from our sacred books to God to Moses, it seems to me the emphasis always is on doing action to live out your beliefs. Faith is important. Many of us as Jews think that actions are where we really express our values. So, given all that, what about the topic of tonight? Here's what I believe, and here's what I think is a reasonable depiction of mainstream Judaism on this issue of religion and politics. First, what most Jews do not believe. Most Jews do not believe it appropriate for there to be a state-sanctioned religion. That probably is historical, perhaps more than what the texts say. Like many peoples, we have lived in enough countries where there was one state-sanctioned religion to see not only what happened to us, but what happened to anyone who was of a different religion or no religion. Religion can do wonderful things, as we all know. Religion can do awful things. If it has the power of the state, we worry. So we do not want that. We believe with Jefferson in a strict wall of separation between church and state. But if you notice the topic tonight, it's not exactly the words church and state, is it? It's religion and politics. So having set aside over here or somewhere what we do not believe as Jews, that there should be an intermingling of state-sponsored religion, I think many Jews and I are much more comfortable with the notion of religion influencing in some ways our politics. And I'll try to at least make a beginning notion of how we think that can work. Most Jews, and myself certainly included, not only do not like, but take great offense that some people take one line from Leviticus that says homosexual acts are abhorrent, that's the English translation of that Hebrew word, and come to the conclusion that all homosexuality is wrong, that people who are homosexual should not enjoy the same blessings and freedoms and rights that the rest of us have. Whatever our view on homosexuality, we don't like taking one line and coming to extraordinary consequences. There's no line in the Bible, in the Hebrew Bible, that says homosexuality is fine, but there are many, many lines that talk about humaneness and kindness and all of us being God's children. So as you know, you could take any line and counterpose it with any other line. We do not like to see one line become the stated position. But on a more positive side, if we look at abortion, still, and I'm sure for years, a raging debate, the Jewish position is much more nuanced, and I think many of us Jews would be very comfortable, whether it's a Jewish legislator or someone else, referring to our religious upbringings as shaping their beliefs. Here's how Judaism looks at abortion, as best I understand it. In the Talmud, the rabbis say that the fetus up to 40 days old is not a human being. The most orthodox of rabbis have no problem with abortion up to a fetus being 40 days old. And then from 40 days till just as the fetus is ready to be born, the Jewish tradition seems to say this is a becoming living being. It's an emerging being. And because we put such an emphasis on life, you have to meet fairly high standards to be willing to abort that emerging living being. But we have a hierarchy of values, and we say that the mother's life, being that she is not within a womb, but that she is a fully living being, her life must take precedent if the emerging fetus, whether 6 months old or just about to be born, is a threat to her physical or perhaps her mental health. And so we have conflicting views, and we set up a hierarchy. If we had a legislator who said, by my religious beliefs, to casually abort a child at age 6 months, a fetus at age 6 months, excuse me, because it's inconvenient, I'm against that. Most of us Jews would say, good, we shouldn't be casual, even though that's not a fully independent human being. And so we would see a gradation. And referring to our Jewish upbringing, if it's a Jewish policymaker, I think most of us would be very comfortable because it would be someone who's trying to balance these various needs. Let me finish for now by citing a book that, as far as I know, is not written by a Jewish individual, and it's not a book about Judaism. It's a book about our founding fathers. I just started to get into it, so there's much more I don't know about it, but I think I understand where the author's coming from, so I'll try to give you a hint. I'm going to mention this book because I think we Jews would be very comfortable with this view. The book is American Gospel. Evan Meacham is the author. I think he sometimes writes for Newsweek. Here's Meacham's take on religion and politics, as the founders believed. He says that our founders, deeply religious men, all men, had many opportunities to declare our emerging republic a Christian nation, but as you know, they never did. They could have. They could have used, he argued, Christian images and Christian language in the Declaration of Independence, in the Constitution. By and large, they didn't. He says, and I quote, "In the public business of the nation, it was important to the founders to speak of a God in a way that was unifying, not divisive." And so, he says, the founders believe that religion in private is ours. You can pray however you like or not pray. They were comfortable with that. They wanted to have God and God-like language spoken in public, as long as it was unifying and not divisive. They wanted, says Meacham, for Americans to be both reverent and tolerant. And I think mainstream Judaism could not agree more. So like the founders, I think that most Jews are comfortable seeing religious values discussed in politics, but not religious dogma. Using religious values, as I mentioned with abortion, to guide, to help us think through the challenges and the competing values, doing it that way encourages us to think and to learn and be open to different people's views and to act as we best can morally. But when it's dogma, it closes us down to anyone who's different. And that's not the Jewish way. I'll look forward to the discussion. Thank you.
Helena Cobham writes regularly for the Christian Science Monitor, for Al Hayat of London, frequently for the Boston Review, and for a lot of other publications whenever they seek someone who actually knows something about the Middle East. Reared in the Society of Friends, she writes as a committed and thoughtful believer in peace and nonviolence. Her weblog, justworldnews.org, makes the required list from all of us concerned about the Middle East. Although recently she's used it to trumpet her remarkable skill at a game called 60 Second Per Quacky, in which she once scored 4,200 points in one 1-minute turn. Her blog has reported nothing of the skill level of the person she most frequently plays against. She's just completed a new book, which sounds fascinating. It's titled Amnesty After Atrocity, Healing Nations After Genocide and War Crimes. I wish it sounded less topical. Helen?
Well, thank you, Carl, and Hal, and everybody else who put this on. I wish I could say there were more seats. There's one seat here. thank you all for turning out. This is a really important topic. I think Carl said I was reared in the Society of Friends. I actually wasn't. I was raised an Anglican, which in England is... Okay, some of my best friends are still Anglicans. In England, it's sort of the default option. You know, if you're not anything else, then you're Anglican. But for a number of reasons, well, primarily because I spent a lot of time in Lebanon during the Civil War, and I saw religion being abused so horribly there in the name of war and politics that I was turned off organized religion completely for a long while. I have a friend in our Quaker meeting here who says our slogan should be, if you're fed up with organized religion, become a Quaker. But actually, that's not true. We have a very robust form of organization. And looking around now, I can see a lot of wonderful Quaker friends here this evening, so that's great. Quakers are a very special kind of denomination, and since some of you may not be familiar with what we do and what we stand for, I thought I would just quickly run through Quakers and how we are in this state, in this community, in this country, and in the world. There have been Quakers here in Virginia since the end of the 16th century, and George Fox, the founder of Quakerism, even came to Virginia and traveled up and down a little bit, mainly in the Tidewater area, I believe. Quakers don't have a creed. We have testimonies that don't even add up to a creed. We believe that every individual is responsible for her or his spiritual development and relationship with the Almighty. But the testimonies are there to guide us. We have three primary kinds of testimony. The testimony of equality, which I find, well, I find them all very powerful. The testimony of equality is based on our understanding that there is that of God in everyone. And even somebody who does an action that you radically disagree with has that of God in her or him. And therefore, it's a call to us to give equal honor to that of God in everyone. And well, I'll speak a little bit more about it later. Second testimony is the peace testimony, and this is perhaps what Quakers are best known for. I break it down into two parts, and one is a prescription against using violence. And of course, we can have a long discussion: what is violence? What is it that we're against? And then the second part of it is a belief that nonviolent ways do always exist, which I think is equally important, because it doesn't mean that you just sit back and do nothing. I mean, pacifism is spelt with a C. It is not spelt with two S's, if you see what I mean. And therefore, you know, when something happens where maybe you're tempted to have a violent response, for example, human rights abuses in Kosovo and people are agitating for a U.S. military response, we don't say do nothing. We say there are nonviolent ways. We just need to work even harder to find out what they are. And then our third testimony is the testimony of simplicity. I'm not very good at this one, but I do work at it. It has a lot of dimensions as well. Simplicity of speech, that Quakers don't take oaths. We think that our word should just stand for what it is. I'm a little bit florid in the way that I write sometimes, so I don't use simplicity in my speech, written speech, all the time. And of course, historically, Quakers would wear simple gray clothes, and a lot of other ways in which simplicity, which of course is also a sort of an environmentally friendly testimony, if you like, as well as it's very much linked also to the testimony of equality, that, you know, here we are, for example, in the United States, we are 4.5% of humanity, but we consume vastly more than 4.5% of the world's resources, and if all humans are equal, then we should actually act in a way that reflects that, and that would mean a radical simplification of our lifestyle. It's also linked with a testimony of the peace testimony, because as John Woolman, who was a great Quaker, I would say a saint, except we don't do saints. He was a North American Quaker in the 18th century who really is the person who drew me to Quakerism about 12 years ago. And if you haven't read his journal and major essays, I think you should rush out and buy it, actually. But he argued very forcefully for how desire for material aggrandizement was so often the cause of war. And from that point of view, he was like centuries ahead of his time. He was a systems thinker before systems thinking had ever been thought of. A really remarkable person. So as Quakers, we have always thought that our religion should dominate everything we do in the home and in the public square. People may be aware that, you know, here on the East Coast, most of the Quakers, when we worship, we do so in what's called an unprogrammed way, that you go and you sit in a room and nothing happens. That's what people might think. But in fact, we are worshiping together and waiting together on the leadings of the Spirit. And sometimes you can sit there for a whole hour and nobody will speak. And that's fine, too. So the story is that one time somebody sat with the Quakers for an hour and, you know, nobody spoke. And he sort of leant over and he said, "Well, when does the service begin?" And the Quaker next to him said, "As soon as we get out of the room, service begins." So, you know, I think nearly everybody that I know who is a Quaker is intensely involved in social justice activities at one level or another. There are some Quakers who are sort of contemplatives, who spend more time praying for the rest of us, which I really appreciate. I can't tell you how much I appreciate it. And they've played a very important role in this country's history and in several issues around the world. In this country, Quakers have played an important role in the anti-slavery movement, in prison reform, in education, social welfare, just across the board, obviously peace activism. I think that our religion also gives us many guidances for how we should look at relations among countries. And here I mentioned the equality testimony, the idea that, you know, if all humans have that of God in them, then it behooves people to try and, you know, regulate international relations in a way that really respects and honors that. Also, obviously, in terms of the peace testimony, which is very important to most Quakers, including myself. I want to speak just a little bit quickly, because I can't speak, you know, I think you said I'm representing the Friends community. I'm not entirely happy with that, because I'm sure that every single Quaker here would have other things that they would want to say, and I don't claim to represent them wholly. It's sort of like Russ saying, if you have two Jews, you have three opinions. Partly because our religion, our faith, is very personal to us, although we practice it in a corporate way. And I just love the corporate experience of our worship together and what we do as friends together. So I'll just speak a little bit about my personal sources of inspiration for my social justice work. First of all, in no particular order, I have to say, the Beatitudes and other parts of the New Testament and many of the writings of the prophets of the Hebrew Bible. Then John Woolman. And I'll speak a little bit more about John Woolman later. And then I've been very moved and challenged by a lot of Buddhist writings, like the writings of the Dalai Lama and Thich Nhat Hanh, and Buddhist writers who I think really, really connect with that idea of human equality and community in a way that works for me. The writings of Henry Nouwen, is that how you say it? I've only ever seen it. You know, he's a Catholic. How do you say it?
Nouwen.
Okay, thank you. And Dorothy Day and Thomas Merton and many Catholic peace and social activists. And then I would have to say that I've been very inspired by many of the people that I've met on my travels. I have been so blessed to be able to travel to many different countries in the world in pursuit of my work. And most recently, I have just been working on this book. I got the cover of the book. I have to show you the cover. It's really exciting. I guess you can't see it from there. But anyway, I'm really thrilled with it. It's going to come out very soon, and it'll be in paperback in January. That's the point at which people can afford it. But so it's just in the past few years I've really been doing a lot of work in Africa, and I have been so inspired by some of the people that I have met there. I think, you know, I hate to get into sort of cultural essentialism, but the African people that I have met have enormous cultural reserves of spirituality that just informs their whole being in the world. And I'll mention, for example, a traditional healer that I met in Mozambique. Mozambique was a country that was riven by civil war and the most ghastly atrocities, all that we read about now in other wars in Africa, mutilation, abduction of children, forcing the children to go back and commit atrocities against their family members. I mean, it was a society in complete crisis for 15 years, but then they ended it. And the traditional healers and the Christian congregations and the Muslim congregations in Mozambique all worked together to effect sort of healing at the community level and to take back into society both the victims of the violence and the perpetrators of the violence, recognizing that, of course, many of the perpetrators were themselves also victims, and that most of the victims were not innocent. And they took all these people back and reconstituted society with this amazing wealth of traditional healing that they had. And I talked to one of the leaders of the traditional healers there, and he said, well, our goal is that every heart should be a peace factory. It's so simple. It's so powerful. And then I talked to some survivors of the genocide in Rwanda who told me about how when the killers had come into their homes where they were cowering with their families, in fact, these were two men that I talked to in this about this. So, of course, a man is scared not only for himself but for his family because he feels responsible for them in many societies, and it's true. And so he feels powerless because the killers are about to come not just for him but for his family. And these men told me how they had used their Christian teaching to connect with the killers as they came and to remind these individuals of the Christian teaching that they all shared and were able to move their hearts and save their families. Some of them obviously were not able to do that, but there are some remarkable testimonies from the Rwandan genocide of how people used a sort of a reproach that is based on deep Christian doctrine and Christian understanding in order to halt the killers in their tracks. I mean, to me, all this is extremely inspiring and gives me hope for humanity, even though the killing continues in some place or another, and makes me think that so many Americans just don't have any experience of this, of civil war or war in the homeland, and have this sort of cavalier attitude toward war, the idea that you know, war is always over there. And you send the troops over there, and they do something heroic, and they win, and then they come back. And there's not that same appreciation for what is happening in that society that is just infected with violence, and may be infected with violence for many years to come. I did, at the beginning of my career as a journalist, live in Lebanon for 7 years, working there as a journalist during the Civil War. And I, at the time, it was difficult. I was married to a Lebanese person, and I had two children. They're now 28 and 27. They are wonderful people. I can't even call them young people anymore. They're kind of getting to be middle-aged young people. But it was tough at the time to try to do my job and raise my children and run the household in a civil war. And I had many friends who were killed, and because of my job, I had to go and witness and write about many massacres. Life was tough. It was hard to put my son Tariq on the school bus, and you know, you kind of, my God, will he come home? Hard to leave the house in the morning sometimes and go to the office and get on with my job. Hard to travel down to the basement and carry up the jerry cans of water up 7 flights of stairs because, you know, the electricity has gone out and there's no pumps. Stuff like that, that people who live in war zones understand very well indeed what war does to societies. And Americans are so blessed. Most of us don't know how blessed we are. That it's actually been since 1812, you know, when my other country sent warships up the Potomac and whomped the White House. And I guess that was Dolly Madison. She was a Quaker. She was inside the White House, so she probably understood a little bit. But, you know, war in one's own country is the most awful experience. And so I guess I feel now that I'm blessed that I had that experience. It didn't feel like a blessing at the time. But it does enable me to come back and really, you know, talk about the peace testimony and reflect on the peace testimony in a way that otherwise might be very academic and abstract. I'll just quickly wrap up by talking about a couple of things that I learned from John Woolman about things that are important in political activism. One is the theory of effecting social change through persuasion rather than through outvoting or other forms of dominance. Quakers have this very ambivalent relationship with voting. I mean, we're all for it in the public sphere, but we don't do it ourselves. We can talk about that more, but I think in the public sphere there's probably no alternative but to vote. But it does leave open the possibility of the domination of the majority over the minority, which we have to be very attentive to. So John Woolman grew up. I have to tell the story really fast. So Quakers weren't always good. We weren't as good as the Mennonites. The Mennonites never had slaves. The Quakers used to have slaves. Not many people know that. They think we're sort of so saintly. But and George Fox, when he came here, he traveled up and down. He saw Quakers holding slaves, and he was concerned about it. But he said, well, you know, if they educate these slaves, and, you know, maybe for a generation or two, and then they can get to the level of the white people. It was a very racist theory. Then it's okay, and sort of it was a slippery slope type thing. By giving them sort of permission, then Quakers went on and they were holding slaves, trading in slaves, actually engaged in the transcontinental shipment of slaves in the most grotesque way. This guy, John Woolman, from New Jersey, was deeply convinced, along with some other Quakers from New Jersey and Pennsylvania, that slavery was an abomination against this theory that there is that of God in everyone. And so he took it upon himself to try to persuade the entire religious society of Friends, all the Quakers in this country, that slavery was indeed an abomination and they should dissociate themselves from it. It took him, well, he didn't achieve it in his lifetime, but he and his friends in this anti-slavery movement traveled up and down the East Coast talking to their fellow Quakers one-on-one and in small groups, until after many decades they had persuaded all the Quakers, meeting by meeting by meeting, to dissociate themselves from the practice of slavery. And then, as we know, in the next century, in the 19th century, the Quakers were at the heart of the anti-slavery movement. But to me, it's that idea that you effect social change by persuasion, even if it's a long, long haul. And I saw the same thing with Archbishop Tutu, you know, the way that he persuaded the white folks in South Africa that apartheid was wrong. And I see the same thing with the Dalai Lama when he says, for example, that if you're fighting for a social justice goal and you use violence, you may think it'll be quicker, but any gain you get will not be a lasting gain. And so it can go away, you know, the day after, and meantime, by having launched some violence into the world, you're sending out a cascade of violence into the world that will carry on, and you have to take responsibility for what you have done in that regard. So I think all of these come together with this idea that, you know, if I very strongly disagree with, for example, a U.S. president, I am not going to use violence, and I am not going to sort of use waterboarding or any of those kind of things in order to get him to say, okay, I agree, Helena, I will stop, you know, I will withdraw the troops from Iraq. That's not how we would do it. We would reach out to him in love. We do. We regularly do this. I mean, not regularly, but frequently we call for more love for the president. And in the context of that, we would try to call him to his better self. And so you reach out to that of God in people with whose actions you strongly disagree. And, you know, that's just a sort of a little take on John Woolman. And another couple of great stories here, and then I'll come to a close, is, you know, there was this thing that the Anglo colonists here in this continent used to call the French and Indian Wars, which, of course, the French and Indian, no doubt, had their own name for. And all Philadelphia was kind of a bustle of war mobilization, and they were dragging through the streets the dismembered corpses of some colonists who had been aggressed against by the Indians, and they were raising taxes for war, and it was all a big to-do. And John Woolman said, you know, I want to go out and meet the Indians. And so he just set out with I guess it was a Mennonite or a Moravian pastor, and the two of them traveled into western Pennsylvania. And as he writes about this in his journal, he says, I went to see if I could meet some of these Indians, to see if I could share the good news with them, that is the gospel, and to see if haply, I love that word, haply, very good in word games, if haply I could learn from them. To me, that is so powerful. The idea that you're not just going to share your good news, but heck, you can learn from somebody else with a very, very different worldview. I mean, that's just great. And then finally, while he's out there, you know, meeting with these Indians, and there's a Moravian, I guess, and they're sitting together in a hut. And obviously the hut, you can imagine it was shady and, you know, shadowy, and you can't see exactly what's happening. And he sees an Indian at the door with a tomahawk raised like this. And so what does he do? He says, I put out my hand and I spoke to him in a friendly way, because I thought that he was probably startled to see a white man there and acting out of his fear. And so he completely succeeded in defusing what might otherwise have been a really horrible massacre. Anyway, those are the kind of things that move me, and I have some wonderful books. Oh, this is a book by my friend Ron Mock, who is a Quaker, an evangelical Quaker. I haven't even told you. There are evangelical Quakers, okay? Most of them are in the West, on the West Coast. And they are wonderful people. They do the most amazing work. This is a book by my friend Ron Mock, who teaches at George Fox University on the West Coast, on how you can actually respond to terrorism in nonviolent ways. And I mean, I've read the book and love a lot of it, but I just love the title more than anything, which is Loving Without Giving In. So I'll leave you with that.
Thank you, Helena. It's thoroughly subversive. Abdulaziz Sachedina teaches religion at the university, but his international fame lies in his remarkable role as one of the great Shia intellectuals. I can attest that the State Department consulted with him as frequently as he would allow them it to, and was frequently frustrated when his other obligations kept him away. He has thought a great deal about Islam and politics, and done a lot of that thinking before the U.S. government asked him to help work on the Iraqi constitution. In 1998, he published The Just Ruler in Shiite Islam, dealing with the proper rule of jurists, and in 2000, Islamic Roots of Democratic Pluralism. I owe a particular and somewhat peculiar debt to Professor Sachedina. My daughter took his class as an undergraduate, and not only passed it, but also gained the sort of intellectual growth and respect for learning that we send our kids to school to get. I think he'll do a lot of that for us tonight. Thank you.
Thank you very much for being here tonight. I didn't expect the crowd at all. I thought we'll end up with a seminar of 50 people, 40 people at the most. But I'm really happy to see you all, and I think it's the topic which is very timely. Religion in politics is on our minds. I don't have to tell you about Islam. You know more than I do. You've been hearing from the media every day, you know, and they've been teaching you a crash course on Islam, on Muslims, on terrorism, on Islam is equal to terrorism, Muslim equal to an evil person. All these things are coming to you quite easily. I am fully aware even of the context in which we should also consider the word religion and politics, because both these words are loaded for all of us here in this audience. I think when we hear religion, it somehow associates our ideas to something that we know very negatively and sometimes even pejoratively. I think religion does appear as not something that is likable in terms of creating civil society, in terms of creating a peaceful world. And therefore, all religions in the world are actually struggling to show the ideal side of their teachings, which then are actually confronted with the realities, which are far more harsher in our judgment when we see the behavior of the people. I must begin by saying that that's not the meaning of religion in the Abrahamic traditions, whose continuation is Islam. Islam sees itself organically related to the biblical ethos. It is connected to the Hebrew Bible, to the New Testament, and therefore it sees itself as coming out of the Semitic anthropology. Understanding the Semites is extremely important for us to somehow relate religion and politics. Near Eastern cultures did not separate the two at all. They saw a religious person also in the role of politics, because politics for the Near Eastern cultures is not dirty. It needs to be reined. It needs to be brought to the moral and ethical standards so that it can produce the just polity. You can't be religious in Near Eastern cultures without committing yourself to justice. Spirituality and morality are intertwined. You can't be spiritual in some kind of mystical way, having no relationships at all with the people who are real, who are seeking your relationship, who are seeking your connection. In other words, religion is to be translated into connectedness. The moment you connect people, there is struggle. There's power struggle, struggle of influence, and all relationships work out in such a way that unless you bring fairness and justice to bear upon relationships, those relationships are doomed to fail. That's why we came to a decision. The secularists told us, individualism is a solution. You take care of yourself, leave others. Love thy neighbor as you love thyself doesn't apply to you anymore. Just love them in your heart. You don't have to do anything for them. And that's why when you live sometimes, I live in a neighborhood. 25 years, 28 years, I don't know my neighbors. Is this the love thy neighbor as you love thyself, as Christ taught us? Or as Muhammad taught us? Or as Hebrew Bible tells us? No. It's different. That means I should show my concern. I can't be indifferent. The moment I become indifferent, I'm hurting my spirituality. I can't be spiritual on my own. Living individually, me first, I count first, I come first. No, that's fine. You need to take your self-interest into consideration. But without the sensitivity, without the sacrifice, how are you going to increase the relationship to its best possible manifestation? That's where politics come. Politics is not dirty. In Arabic, the word for politics is siyasa. You want to imagine the metaphor of a wild horse that needs to be reined, domesticated? Politics is a wild horse. You domesticate it by putting religion on it. Because religion teaches you the value of connectedness. Religio, in even Latin language, is to connect people in a creed, in a community, to bring them together so that they cooperate with one another to create what is known as God's kingdom on earth. So how can we say religion and politics are separate? Yes, I'm worried about the tyranny of religion, but so am I worried about the tyranny of politics. Both can go extreme and wild. We need to rein this. How do we rein it? This is where I think Islam gives a very interesting example. It's not theocracy that you are worried about. There's no theocracy as such. Even the prophetic religions did not and were not able to create theocratic states. They were papal states, they were church states, they were controlled by what we call a specific interpretation of the religion. And it suited the purpose in the times. Now the times have come whereby people are empowered. There's empowerment of the people. And therefore, the institutions become somehow diluted. When you empower the people, they become institutionalized. And that empowerment leads to demand. People are demanding today. You and I, in a democratic system, we demand our rights. We are fighting for our rights, and we don't let any government official run away with our rights. We'll fight them. Now, if this is what it is, politics, then Islam says, creating a just polity right here is your obligation. Al-amr bil ma'ruf wa nahy anil munkar. You are supposed to institutionalize, institute good, and prevent evil. How do you do it? We work with children. Does persuasion all the time work? My wife used to call me a softy father. I was not willing to use my hand on my two sons. She said, if you don't use it sometimes, really you must use it. Force is necessary. Violence then is a strategy. It's not a principle. Like Nelson Mandela made it very clear. That I don't believe like Gandhi that non-violence is a principle, it's a strategy. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't work. Why do we have these police running around? If all of us were obedient citizens, there would be no need for the police. There would be no need for red lights and green lights to control our behavior. But human beings can go wild in their own self-satisfying motivations. And that's why you need the religion to tell you, you must learn altruism. You must learn to take the rights of the others into consideration. Christianity does it, Judaism does it, Islam does it. All these three religions, these Abrahamic traditions are geared towards what we call justice. Judaism began that, justice as a principle, and other religions followed it. That no, you need to bind yourself with justice. The moment you bind yourself with justice, you are confronted with a situation whereby politics will enter your personal faith. I see injustices happen on the street. Should I remain indifferent? I was in Damascus after the Lebanon-Israel war. I was in Damascus. Thousands of people homeless. Well, I could go very, you know, individualistically say, well, it's none of my business. I'm here as a tourist. Let me enjoy in my 5-star hotel. Enjoy myself. Go back to the U.S. Would I be faithful then to my own personal beliefs as my own spiritual and moral growth? How can I justify it? I'm in the 5-star hotel. There are people who don't have any place to go. What is my responsibility to God when I'm asked on the day of judgment, what did you do? I gave you. I gave you so much. What did you do with it? I go sometimes in Iran. I was there last year teaching. A student comes to me and says, and he brings me a letter. He gives me a letter. And he goes away. I read the letter. I'm a medical student. I don't have money to buy food. I don't have money to buy books. So I try to see if there's a phone number or anything. I don't see anything. And the student didn't come for 2 weeks. So I go. Now, my reaction could have been this. Say, well, he wrote it. He never came back to ask me if I could help him. But maybe out of self-respect, he could not face me anymore. There was a pride involved. He had already lowered himself by putting a letter in my hand, a petition, so to speak. And here I was supposed to answer, to respond. I could have been very indifferent, very materialistic. It's none of my business. I'm here, a visiting professor. I don't have to do anything. But no, I went. I searched for him. I found him in a dorm. When he came back to my office after 3 weeks that I searched and found him, I said, how much do you need? He said, I need $60 a month. You and I, in my children, I know my boys, when they go to the movie, $50, phew, it goes. For us men, money has no value. And therefore, our accountability is even greater. If you don't have, you don't have to account for. If you have, you have to account for. That's what religion teaches. That's what Islam says. You will be asked for everything that you've been given. You're strong, you're muscular. If you just go to the gym and work out and do nothing to help communities, to build homes or anything else, then you have failed utterly. Your muscles are not only for your beauty, but they are there to help others. That's politics. That's politics. Can we ethicize politics? Can we make politics moral? That's what Martin Buber was worried about. When he talks about the two communities in Israel, in the Holy Land, he was worried about the ethics of the politics. Will we be able to be ethical or not? In recognizing the rights of the others, Muslims are faced with that question, because the moment you have power and you connect the power with religion, religion gets corrupted. Islam and politics. It has a long history. It's very dialectical. It doesn't have a lot to be proud of all the time. But it didn't fail either completely. What it did was that it made human beings aware that you have a moral choice to make. If you accept one God, then you will also accept the responsibility of making this society a better one. You can't make it a better one if you don't struggle. That's the meaning of jihad, by the way. Jihad is to struggle, to strive. I'm constantly in jihad with myself. Will I be egotistic? Will not care for my students? Will not care for my family? Will not care for other citizens? Or will I sacrifice my life for them? The choices are ours. You can have then Mother Teresa going in Calcutta in the name of Christ, picking up children who are thrown away, who are wasted, so to speak, and she picks them up and gives them home. In love of Christ, she does it, right? And we all praise her. That's the politics of Jesus. Therefore then, I think our conclusion is, rather somehow we are dominated by what we call the modernity. And modernity says, keep these two separate, because we have a very bitter experience. Our founding fathers, when they came, when we landed in Massachusetts in the 16th century, we had these Puritans who were driving us crazy, right? They were telling us, you must follow the Bible. You must implement it every day. And we were surprised. We said, oh my God, how are we going to deal with it? We have so many different denominations. At that time, the Jews and the Muslims did not have that loud presence in American social universe. I think even I read this somewhere, I think, when the founding fathers were writing constitution, they were not even thinking about Jews being able to go to vote at that point. Just as the blacks were not going to vote, the Jews were not going, and Muslims were not even non-existent. They didn't even know about them. Maybe they didn't know, I know. But although some writings do show that they knew about the Mohammedans. What I'm trying to say is that many a times, religion brings out in us our spiritual values. And our spiritual values are not empty. Believe me, my friends tonight. If I want to be spiritual, then I will show my concern for you. The moment I show my concern for you, I'm political. If that's what you mean. Because I'll be worried about you. Like my neighbor tells me, if I don't see your car parked, I'm worried. Where are you? For days I haven't seen you out. I knocked the door of my neighbor once and I told him, I haven't seen you for 15 days. And he was surprised. This brown fellow, you know, he's worried about me. He said, I had a back problem. I said, but oh my goodness, I should come and help you. I know how to give massage. Oh no, I don't need help. Now that's his choice, but my choice was very clear. For me, it was a universal message as a Muslim that I can't become indifferent. I can't live indifferent. The moment I become indifferent, I lose my membership in the human community, let alone my religious community. I'm no more a member of my human community. If I show my indifference to the people in Charlottesville, where my first obligation begins, then I have utterly failed as a Muslim. In other words, Islam is submission to the will of God, surrender to the will of God, in the sense that I have picked up the moral challenge. Moral challenge is not only to become better, spiritually and morally stronger, but also to enable others, also in a very peaceful way. I think I see a role for religion in 21st century. All of a sudden we become aware that there could be religious democracy also in this world. I think the paradigm that the secularists are presenting us has not provided us with all the questions, all the answers to the very ultimate questions. Therefore we are people in Israel. I've talked to them. We were sent by UN for 3 weeks in Jerusalem. We were supposed to build bridges between Jews, Christians and Muslims. I met the rabbis, I met the imams, we met different peoples. And they all knew that religion had a role to play in the human life, which was very critical and central, provided religion was to become ethical and not doctrinal. The moment you bring the doctrines and orthodoxy, then you have a problem. Not everybody agrees with you. But the moment you bring a common cause, then look, we are all against torture. We are all against humiliation. We are all against, you know, not helping the poor people. We should be helping the poor people. I think the moment you create that, and that's where I think Quakerism does succeed on many occasions. Quakerism in Kenya is very active. They have a church. Because in Kenya, the Africans do expect Quakers to have a building somewhere where they can meet and have services. So even if here we might not have service, because we are here too intellectual. I think we can move in that direction of meditation and silence. Not the Africans. They want it very loud and clear to have a church. So we have Quaker church in Kenya, Nakuru. And they meet and they are working very hard. What I see in the people of religions today, they can make a common cause to work for the betterment of the entire humanity. If our political leaders would listen to the sincere religious leaders, then we'll be able to solve many problems that we face today as human beings. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a discussion on the role of religion in politics, Jewish, Christian, and Islamic perspectives, presented by the group Clergy and Laity United for Justice and Peace. For more information, visit their website at cljp.org.